Involvement with the criminal justice system is life-changing. It matters.
Having a justice system that works is a really important part of a democratic society.
I'm Penelope Gibbs, Director of Transform Justice.
I'm Rob Allen. I've worked in and around criminal justice all my career.
This is the Transform Justice podcast, throwing light on the criminal justice system.
Hearing from people who know.
It's about whether the system's fair.
And what can be done to make it better.
Today we'll be discussing a contentious issue, hate crime, and how society should deal with it. I'm joined by two people who wrestle with its ramifications every day. Neil Chakraborty is Professor of Criminology at Leicester University, and Tony Burnett runs Kick It Out, a charity fighting hate in football. And I'm also joined by my co-host, of course, Rob Allen. Rob, you're a big sports fan, particularly rugby, and frequently stand on the touchlines of your children's games. What have you seen in the way of hate speech or hate crime?
Luckily, watching my kids play rugby, I haven't personally seen or heard any racist or homophobic language on the sidelines. Maybe I'm not the best person to ask about that as a white middle-class male, but I think it's partly the Rugby Football Union has produced a very good code of conduct for spectators, which really encourages parents and others watching to behave well. I have seen referees send parents from the touchline, but on racism and homophobic comments, thankfully not.
Tony, let's look back to the European Championship and the final game. There was a massive response online to the penalty shootout, with the players of colour getting a lot of hate tweets and other things. Why do you think it hit the headlines quite in that way when the problem of these hate tweets was quite long standing?
I think online hate is a huge problem in football, obviously, and in society. We've been quite active in the development of the online safety bill that is still going through Parliament. But the events of Euro 2020, I was at the game actually, and as soon as the second penalty was missed, I turned to my colleague and said, "We better prepare because we're going to get lots and lots of reports of hate incidents now." We knew it was going to happen. We had these conversations with some of the social media organisations prior to the tournament happening. And the question I kind of asked straight afterwards, why wasn't more done to stop it and to prevent those awful comments getting through to those three young men? And the social media organisations didn't give any adequate explanation as to why they hadn't done that. The second bit, Penelope, really for me was because of the size of the audience, I think what it did for the first time was it really illuminated the issue of hate crime and racism. People who would never normally engage with football had seen the horrifying nature of what hate crime and racism looks like and discrimination. And I think the positive aspect out of it is I do think perceptions change because people's awareness was raised around what's really going on in sport and society.
Neil, you're a supporter of Derby County, I understand. Have you experienced or witnessed hate crime at matches you've been to?
I have, Rob, very regularly. It can be quite a difficult space to be in as somebody from a visible minority background. I think things have got easier over the years. It was something that I wasn't perhaps as aware of when I was a child. I knew that people were looking at me and sometimes you'd hear comments, but in the 80s, early 90s, I don't know. I don't know whether I was at a stage in my life where I really processed that. I found going away from home particularly challenging because it's not just what happens inside the ground, it's what happens when you're on a bus or on a train or you're traveling and you're walking, and sometimes you can experience hostility from your fellow fans, from your own team. So I found that quite difficult. And now as a parent of young kids, sometimes the hostility that I hear, not just in terms of racial hostility, I think we're a lot better at dealing with that within the grounds than in the years that have passed. But I think it's an environment in which hostility is normalised. The kind of language, the behaviour that we see when a member of the opposition is taking a corner. And also the lack of visible difference, Rob, is something that's so stark in football. Not so much in terms of the playing staff, but in terms of the officials. So whether it's referees or referees' assistants or coaches, managers, we just don't see people of colour typically in those kinds of positions. And again, it creates, perhaps not intentionally, but it creates and normalises this impression amongst most fans that there are acceptable divisions between people in society. So, yeah, I think it can be a difficult space for people from a visible minority.
And have you been able to kind of intervene or get involved in any way if you've personally been victimised or you hear or see people saying things, or is it just too difficult to do that?
A bit of both, Rob. I have found it very difficult because you need allies within a football ground, and when it's you or your family members alone saying, I don't think that's right, you can tell a steward and you can report it, but often, as in life outside of football, the processes can be quite complex and time-consuming and you get a sense of indifference. So, yeah, on occasions where I have flagged things up, I've been disappointed with the response that I've got. But I think it runs deeper than that. It's not just the responsibility of the football club. I think all of us collectively as citizens have a responsibility to be kinder.
Tony, what do you think? You've talked a bit about online abuse, but that's obviously not the only focus of hate at football. Do you agree with Neil that in a way, things have got a bit better, but there's still a lot to do?
It's very interesting, this one. I don't know if you saw the report that was released yesterday by UK Football Policing. They reported a 99% increase last season in hate crime, essentially criminal charges. And that's on the back of a massive increase in appalling behaviours, actually, when it comes to football. And I've worked in lots of different industries in my age, and latterly being kind of policing before I joined Kick It Out. The behavioural standards that are accepted in football are just not accepted in any other workplace. And I'll just use one very minor example. I went to the Forest game, Forest v Fulham, last Friday night, sat in the stand, looking at the box where the managers and coaches stand, and watched a coach harangue a referee, the fourth official, in an unbelievable way. Now, the excuse that's often used around football is that it's a really stressful environment and it's passionate, etc., etc. And I was trying to relate this to, what could I compare this to? You know, one of the stressful situations that we've been in, I guess, as parents, many of us, your child's ill, you go into A&E, God forbid, you're forced to fill in forms and wait in a queue. You can sometimes get a bit upset, but they tell you, and the signs everywhere saying inappropriate behaviour is not acceptable, and you calm down and you address it. That's probably the most stressful situation I can certainly think of. I certainly can't think of sitting on a bench watching a football game thinking it's okay to scream and shout in the face of an official. The message that sends to the people watching the game is that barracking, berating, shouting, screaming, verbally abusing, swearing at people is okay. And I think we've got to start with, absolutely, the stands are a key aspect. But I think we've also got to look at what's going on the pitch and in and around the professionals that work in this environment and address that, because that's not setting the standard I think we should be setting in football.
Moving on to something else you mentioned, which is about an increase in criminal charges in relation to football hate crime. Neil, when does something hateful become a hate crime? Because obviously there's a lot of hate out there, but a crime is something different.
Yeah, absolutely. So hate crimes, acts of violence or hostility directed at people because of who they are. The law currently recognises 5 protected characteristics: race, religion, sexual orientation, disability and transgender identity. So they're the characteristics that set hate incidents and hate crimes as apart from non-hate crimes and non-hate incidents, if you like. I think it's important to have this category for reasons that Tony's already alluded to, but we know that hate incidents typically have a disproportionate psychological, in some cases, a disproportionate physical impact on victims and wider communities. We know that hate crimes are socially divisive and can heighten tensions between communities. And we know that they're likely to involve repeated victimisation. So I think, Penelope, they're the factors that set hate crimes apart from non-hate crimes.
But we've heard a lot from Tony and yourself about, you know, hate speech on travel at football games. And obviously there's the whole of the rest of life. Presumably, there's tons of hate crime which is not actually dealt with by the police. It happens, but goes nowhere.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a huge volume out there, and it's a difficult task for the police because at one level, they're obliged to record hate incidents as well as criminal offences. So in theory, that covers, as you've alluded to, a huge volume of behaviour. But the police are also obliged to apply proportionality, common sense and discretion when deciding to record. So whilst the victim's perspective is paramount when deciding whether or not a hate incident has taken place, the police do have an element of discretion when deciding whether to record or not. So what you're left with, Penelope, is this really difficult space, I think, for everybody involved, where we're seeing increasing levels of hate incidents taking place. But the evidence suggests that relatively small numbers get reported to the police. 24% is the most accurate figure that we have. And then we see further attrition at recording levels, at prosecution, at conviction, and at sentencing. So in essence, there's a real disconnect between the volume of hate and hostility that's been experienced within society and then the criminal justice response to that hate. And it leads many of us to the conclusion that there are better pathways for dealing with these kinds of incidents than the sole reliance on a criminal justice system.
Tony, you mentioned that the number of sanctions and orders and so on designed to kind of curb football crime have increased quite a lot over the last season. Do you think that's because the amount of it's gone up or the system is beginning to get a grip on it? And if it is getting a grip on it through more use of the sanctions, who's behind that? Is it the clubs? Is it the government? Are the fans themselves behind this sort of approach?
Again, I think this is complex. I think there is a quantum increase in overall complaints. If I look at our discrimination reporting process, we are seeing a significant increase year on year, yet again, in terms of numbers of incidents reported. But I think, as Neil said, you know, one of the challenges is partly definition for us around kind of hate crime. So we have a weekly meeting with UKFPU where we look at what complaints have come into our system the previous week and we triage them. Did they meet the criminal threshold? Please take them away. But some of the other channels are also kind of really important. Grassroots is a good example that don't necessarily meet the criminal threshold. We've got to work with the stakeholders to deal with those things better, because a victim, absolutely, if they think it's not going to be criminal, they still want to see a resolution. And we're not good enough as a game and a sport in terms of resolving issues that victims go through in a timely manner. So, for example, if I'm a kid playing in grassroots, it can be 6 months before one of my grievance, my issue is dealt with, and then it might not be dealt with in a way that I expect it to be dealt with. So there's a lot of stuff we can do. Part of it's about supporting the criminal justice system to effect prosecutions, but there's a huge amount of other stuff we need to do to improve the experience of victims.
I mean, can you give us an example, Tony? I mean, if a fan is racially abusing a player loudly from the stand, you know, over and over again during a game, they're identified by a steward. I mean, what's the likely kind of outcome of that? Is that likely to go somewhere and they're likely to be suspended, banned from going, or is it going to be words of warning, or what's your experience?
Yeah, it depends, Rob. If somebody shouts something that is very directly, discriminatory, quite often that's dealt with. As I said, at this Forest game on Friday, I was sat with a colleague from Aston Villa who were playing the same night, and she got a text message on her phone to say somebody had made a discriminatory comment. Police had picked it up, but it was being dealt with there and then. Where it gets more challenging in the professional game is where you've got groups. So, for example, the Spurs fans are renowned for chanting a chant that is discriminatory against the Jewish community. The Jewish community have asked them to stop. How do you tackle 3,000 or 4,000 people all chanting the same thing, which is offensive? The bigger one for me, to be honest, Rob, is as I said, is it grassroots? The stuff that we see in professional game has got mechanisms and support structures to deal with it. In grassroots, we see cases all the time where people are abused, where the local county football association isn't equipped to deal with that abuse and you know, channel it in the right way. And the victim ends up feeling like their issue hasn't been taken seriously at all. So I think there are two completely separate games as far as we're concerned when it comes to hate crime.
But do you think involving the police and the courts maybe is the only way or the best way of dealing with these kinds of things?
No, I don't think it's the only way. So we have a fan education program, and we use this particularly for young people who've just occasionally gone to a game, said something stupid, they're regretful afterwards. We have used it for adults who are really remorseful about what they've done or said. Happened after the Euros and they want to go on a journey. And we have a fan education manager that essentially takes them through a process of understanding what they've done, the impact on the victim, you know, why that whatever they've said or done is inappropriate. Quite often we'll go through the context, whether that's about the LGBTQ plus journey or the historical understanding of race and structural racism, to get to a point where that individual then goes back into the world of football and is, for want of a better expression, rehabilitated. Last couple of years, we've had over 80 individuals go through that programme and not a single one has gone on to reoffend from a hate crime perspective in football.
Neil, I mean, we've talked a bit about the police getting involved in enforcement and so on. So for a lot of these crimes, if somebody's prosecuted, they'll just go to the magistrate's court and get a fine. Do you actually think that police enforcement and sanctions at this lower level have any effect on that person in terms of their future behaviour?
I don't, Penelope, I don't think those kinds of measures do anything to address the underlying harms that give rise to future hate offending. I don't think that gives a victim a sense of justice either. And I think it's very clear that we're failing victims in several key ways. We're failing victims because the justice system, from their vantage point, is slow, intimidating and incomprehensible. But we're also failing victims, I think, by failing to recognise what justice means to them. I think justice is kaleidoscopic, it's pluralistic, it's not just simply linked to these tropes that we continue to peddle about punishments and conviction. It's a lived, ongoing experience that evolves over time, and people's needs and expectations change over time as well. So what that requires from us is to move away from these binary positions and to recognise a little bit of nuance. Let's think about this from a more public health perspective. Let's think about holistic interventions. Let's think about what Tony's referred to already, whether it's rehabilitation, community-based interventions, restorative interventions. There's scope to think much more imaginatively about how to address these problems which affect so many people on a daily basis.
I mean, this is maybe putting you on the spot, but can you give an example of a victim you've spoken to and what kind of justice they talk about wanting?
So if I tell you the story of Grant very briefly, Grant is somebody who's encountered hostility throughout his life, directed to him on the basis of his learning disabilities and having a major speech impediment. His childhood and adult life has been tarnished through experiences of bullying, of violence, of exploitation. He's been befriended by a group of youths who used to take him out to the pub and get him horribly drunk and then do nasty, humiliating things to him, like tie him to the train station gates or stub cigarettes out on his body. Now, when I talk to Grant about justice, he gets incredibly frustrated because he's reported on numerous occasions, and he feels sometimes he's passed from agency to agency. When I talk to him, okay, what would work for you? What do you want? He's not interested in seeing offenders going to jail for long periods of time. He's not interested in getting involved in the courts. He wants to see offenders and victims come face to face with one another in safe, mediated environments so people can start to understand the harm that they do, the harm that their words, their behaviour causes. And he remains convinced to this day that if that was the default option in most cases, then we wouldn't see repeat offending.
Neil, what's interesting is I've kind of read a lot of campaigning from disability charities and from LGBTQ plus charities who actually, their big thing about hate crime is about the definition of the crime against them and how they feel kind of short-changed versus crimes which are motivated by religious or racist hate. Is there a disjunct between this campaigning, which is about more punishment, frankly, and the reality of people's lives?
For me, Penelope, I don't think there's a disconnect. I think that there's two factors that need to be clarified. One, that the criminal law needs to be good law, and at the moment it isn't, because it doesn't treat all protected characteristics equally. So not surprisingly, there are some campaign groups who don't understand why somebody assaulted on the basis of their disability doesn't get the same level of protection as somebody who's assaulted on the basis of their race. So,
and can you explain that? Sorry, Neil. As simply as you can you explain why that might be?
Sure. So hate crime laws have developed in quite a piecemeal fashion over the past couple of decades, and we have all sorts of different pieces of legislation. So if there's a hate crime motivated by hostility towards somebody's race or their religion, then that's a standalone offence. It's an aggravated offence, which carries a higher maximum penalty. If that hostility is directed on the basis of sexual orientation or disability or transgender identity, that results in a different penalty. So there is a disconnect there, and it makes no sense to people who encounter hate crime. It doesn't make any sense to any stakeholders, really. And the Law Commission have looked at this, and we're still waiting for any kind of response from the government. Going back very briefly to what you asked, is there a disconnect? I don't think there is. We need good criminal law, but we can also recognise that we don't need to rely exclusively on criminal sanctions. We don't need to rely exclusively on the criminal justice system.
But is there not a risk that in bringing consistency to hate crime law, we will lead to people being punished more harshly?
Well, I don't think there is a risk because of the very high attrition rate. I think research evidence is very consistent in saying that I think the figure is just under 4% of hate crime cases are actually making it to any form of punishment. So I'd rather focus on the 96% and try and ensure that a victim of a hate incident is referred to the most appropriate source of support. And police forces up and down the country have such an important role, not necessarily in taking the lead and in responding to a case, but identifying the most appropriate source of support within that locality to help a particular victim in a particular set of circumstances.
I couldn't agree more with what Neil just said. I think it absolutely is about the most appropriate response for the victim. But I also think we need to think about what outcomes are we trying to drive? Because one of our challenges in West Mids was, because hate crime is not seen as a priority for the force, the right resources aren't allocated, the right level of scrutiny is not applied, et cetera, to something that is a serious offence quite often. But it's complex. As Neil just mentioned, 4% get to prosecution. So what do we do with the 96%? The 96%, just in a football context, rely on the other infrastructure being in place. I'll just give you one example. A few months ago, we had an Asian team playing up in the Northwest. Game kicked off, racial abuse started. The referee happened to be a young Asian guy as well. Hadn't heard the abuse that's going on between the players, but they reported it to him, took the appropriate decision to stop the game. Bear in mind, this is a 14-year-old child who then became the victim of racist abuse himself from the opposition supporters. What then occurred was just bizarre. What should have been a game that came together to support that group of people went straight to denial, actually, and went straight to trying to cover up the incident, went straight to denying the lived experience and what happened on the pitch until the right people got involved, actually, and then the right level of activity was taking place to support the victims in particular, not necessarily to, you know, ban a club or ban individuals, but to support the victim and put the interventions in place. That first response is massively important, and we need far more training around people who are involved in this process to understand how to handle it in the right way to meet the needs of the victims.
Mm. Neil, what about the people who are committing hate crime? Is there a body of research about the perpetrators?
The evidence that's out there is pretty clear and gives us several key messages to work with. First, we know that whilst it's tempting to think of perpetrators as committed haters or people who commit to a particular ideology, that's true in only a small minority of cases. The vast majority of perpetrators are relatively ordinary people doing relatively ordinary things in their everyday lives. And so hostile acts are committed sometimes because of a state of inebriation, sometimes because of mental health conditions. Sometimes, if I'm honest, because we live in a world where we're all given permission to hate by the hostile climate that we're in. Countless people that I've spoken to say that the behaviour directed to them seems so much more severe than ever before, but also nobody steps in, nobody does anything about it because that kind of language, that kind of behaviour is seen as permissible at a senior level. And spills over into everyday life and everyday social situations.
When you say permissible by the way people at a senior level behave, do you mean sort of politicians' use of language, for example, in relation to refugees or migrants and that kind of thing?
I do, Rob. It's a deliberate use of language designed to demonise particular groups and communities and to create binaries of them and us. And whilst that might win votes in some areas, those words, that behaviour, that rhetoric has real life implications on the ground.
Just a couple of examples. If you remember in the run-up to the Euros last year, every kind of media discussion I had, I was asked about taking the knee. And if you remember, some of the politicians, Priti Patel being one of them, kind of came out completely against the notion of taking the knee. But what that attitude leads to is a group of people that think it's okay then to share their views of three black men missing a penalty because it's been legitimised by the culture wars that our government think it's okay to propagate. And I think politicians from all sides actually are not demonstrating appropriate behaviour when it comes to trying to set the standard we all need to follow. And the media as well have got a really important role here. You know, I was asked probably 100 times at least by media whether Kick It Out were for or against taking the knee. I was never once asked by the media why a player's taking the knee, what are the issues in football, what is structural racism, how is it manifesting in football. Never once. It was all about the gesture of taking the knee, and that speaks volumes to where we're at as a society at the minute for me.
Neil, in terms of addressing hate crime, Liz Truss, now our Prime Minister, said during a leadership campaign, it's time for the police to get back to basics and spend their time investigating real crimes, not Twitter rows and hurt feelings. What do you think she was getting at there?
That kind of language doesn't fill me with optimism, Rob, because it seems to hark back to these outdated notions of policing where we see it through some kind of heroic crime fighting lens exclusively, and it fails to recognise the huge job that the police have on their hands in terms of dealing with social behaviours. Now, I agree to some extent in the sense that there have to be limits on what the police can and can't do. And I think looking at hate crime as exclusively a policing responsibility is misguided. But that kind of language gives us the impression, I think, or is designed to give us the impression that policing hate crime is just a waste of time. So it leaves us within our local environments in a position where we need to take responsibility. And we do have some agency. There's great work going on locally, typically in partnership between agencies within and outside criminal justice. And I'd just like to hope that the local messaging and the local interventions still take priority within the difficult times that we're in.
Tony, a lot of this kind of reaction has come in the wake of what's called the Harry Miller case, where he won a case at the High Court about whether a hate crime incident should have been recorded or not. In the wake of that, are you concerned that there's going to be a sort of a veer back to policing withdrawing from this area?
I think there's a risk of that. I mean, this isn't just an issue outside of policing. So I remember lots of conversations within policing amongst different groups, you know, groups that represented Asian officers, groups that represented black officers, about the definition of hate crime and how that applies when police officers abuse each other to a certain level. I think policing itself has got some issues and challenges when it comes to dealing with hate crime. But I think for me, it's more about how do we tackle the macro environment, and we have to have that conversation about why we let this happen and what do we need to do as a society and a culture to change the narrative so that these people don't think it's okay to behave in that way. Because hate crime is just, for me, is just an outpouring of what we've allowed to build in society.
Okay, it's clearly this is a huge and multifaceted problem. We've touched on many aspects of it. We need to draw to a close. If you were Prime Minister, what's the one thing you would do to try and address hate crime? Neil, what do you think?
I'd love, Rob, to see a public health model adopted nationally, which we could all buy into. This would focus more on prevention, on holistic interventions, on evaluating what works in what context and for whom, and a focus that's more on community-based and restorative alternatives and less on punishment exclusively.
Okay, and Tony?
Prevention for me. So I think we need to go back to basics. And we did some stuff with colleagues this week around the history of race and the history of racism we do across all the protected characteristics. It's stuff that our kids should learn in school. And I think if we go back to basics and we start with the young children in school and we teach them real history and real issues around difference, we're far less likely to get to a situation where this stuff is seen as acceptable and people perpetrate this behaviour in adulthood.
Rob?
I was interested in what Tony just said, because I think schools and education, that was the first time we'd mentioned it in the discussion. It's got to start there, hasn't it, really? We've got to learn that this sort of behaviour is just not on.
I agree with that. Thanks, Rob, Neil and Tony. Links to information about Kick It Out and to Neil's own Hidden Hate podcast are in the programme notes. Do listen to Neil's and rate his very highly. But also, if you've been enjoying our podcast, go on ours on Spotify or Apple or anywhere else and rate it highly, please. And if you have an idea for an issue you'd like us to cover, you can contact us on Twitter or use the email address in the programme notes. Until next time, goodbye.
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 Goodbye.